Welcome to the EDUCAUSE podcast. On this podcast, we present a session from the EDUCAUSE 2012 annual conference. The session is titled, Using Predictive Analytics to Improve Student Success. Our speaker is Tristan Denley, Provost and Vice President for Academic and Student Affairs at Austin Peay State University.
It's great to see everyone this morning, and thank you so much for that that very generous introduction. I sort of feel like a fish out of water. I'm a provost surrounded by CIOs, but I hope that you won't hold that against me. I have a misspent youth as a programmer a long time ago. So, and much of the work that I'm going to talk about today has been a really fabulous partnership between the academic side of the house at Austin Peay and the information technology units at Austin Peay. Nothing that I'm going to show you today could have happened if it hadn't been for that very vibrant conversation. And I do want to thank the folk at Austin Peay for the support that they give me there. You know, I think over the last 10 or so years, we have seen a quiet revolution that's happened across education. And I think there are a number of revolutions that are happening, but there's one in particular that I want to sort of to talk about today, and that is a change in the way in which we think of our role of interacting with students. I think when I went to university, I regarded it my role as a student to go to lectures, to do my stuff, and to do the work in the classroom, and I hoped that at the end of that I would be successful. I think that it is now, and it was more the case also that when I did that if I sort of tripped up, if I didn't make the right decisions, if I ended up in the wrong classes, then I think the feeling of the institution was that was my fault, and that I was going to be the one who would reap the ramifications of that. Over the last 10 years, that philosophy has, I believe, very much waned, if not essentially disappeared. Because it is now the case, I think, all across the United States, that step by step, institutions are having to change to realize that those students' failings, those students' lack of performance, they come back to us. It's our students' success that is our success. In Tennessee, we were just talking before we began, but in Tennessee, it is now the case that the state's funding formula, the way that all of the institutions are funded in the state of Tennessee, is completely decided based on outcomes, not on inputs. So it was the case when I went to Austin Peay that we were funded based on how many students we had at the institution. It is now the case that we are funded by how many students graduate from the institution. That's a very different picture and requires us to think in very different kinds of ways. And so, as was alluded to in the introduction, there are lots of things that are happening at Austin Peay about trying to find ways in which we can help our students succeed, putting student success right at the heart of the mission of the institution. And I think it's the case that it isn't really a very foreign heart. I believe that all institutions have always, I think, at the very depth, wanted their students to learn. But what we've realized as we've grappled with that is that whilst we think of higher education as a pathway to future success, that's not the picture that, at least the majority of Austin Peay students up until recently, that's not the picture that they had. I should tell you something about Austin Peay. It's probably not an institution that you may have heard of before. You should at least know our cheer. Our cheer is, "Let's go Peay." And as you can imagine, the students have a lot of fun with that. So you'll never forget us now. Austin Peay has about 10,500 students. We're in the north of Tennessee. We're one of the largest contributors of education to the military. There's a Fort Campbell military base that's just up the road from us. The things that you should know about us is that we are not an institution that has this sort of typical four-year students coming right out of high school kind of picture. Instead, More than half of our students are Pell eligible. More than 60% of our students are first-generation students. So it's a very different kind of picture. And in fact, because of the fact that those students, they don't have an advice system. They don't have the opportunity to go to somebody else and say, well, what was it like when you went to college? How did you do that? So instead, higher education for them, it looks like that. It's a maze. A maze that they have to navigate. A maze that they have to find their way through. And it strikes me as an academic that there's something awfully unfortunate about that. You know, what I alluded to at the beginning was when, for me, when I went to university, and for you when you did too, it was about what happened in the classroom, right? It should be that you earn your degree by doing the work in the classroom, or outside the classroom, or online, or wherever it is you do it, but it's the work you do. Whether it's competency-based or credit-based or whatever it is, it's this learning that's taken place. But very often, students find themselves lost in this maze, and they go down a wrong turn, and it's going down the wrong turn that ends up making the difference as to whether or not they actually graduate or they don't. They end up with a sort of an oppressive kind of list of choices that have to be made. And unfortunately, they're choices that often are largely uninformed. I don't know about you, but I find this picture sort of almost paralyzing. It's just there's so much going on. That's sort of deliberate. I don't know whether you've ever tried this, but I did. Not long after I went to Austin Peay, I sat down to try to make a four-year schedule with all of the information that was available. I was good about it. I chose a discipline that was not my own, that was kind of on the other corner of the university. I'm a mathematician by trade, so I chose something on the opposite side, whatever that might mean, and I thought I'd try to do this. And what I discovered was that it was nowhere near as easy as I thought it was. Very much more difficult. And largely that's because, although in a very well-meaning way we think that we provide information, we don't actually provide the information that the people who have to actually use that information use it or understand it. And I think this is a sort of a general purpose observation about the fact that so often in my life, and my guess is in yours, you're tasked with trying to provide information to somebody else. And the hard thing is providing that information in a way where they are able to digest it, that they are able to use it. So, you know, the example that I give is, well, we have course descriptions in the catalog, but up there is the course description for complex analysis and also a menu in Swedish. And I don't know whether you speak Swedish or complex analysis, but I claim both of them are in a foreign language. And students, when they're about to take complex analysis, they don't know those technical terms. They know them once they finish the class, but not at the beginning. And that's true in almost every discipline. So all of that kind of crystallized to realize that if we really wanted to help our students, then there was an opening for a different kind of information. And what struck me one day as I was traveling and doing some reading was the fact that over the years, we had been squirreling away all kinds of extraordinarily useful information. My suspicion is that on your campuses you have terabytes of grade, historical grade data that just sits there waiting for somebody to come along and say, well, in 1962, I think I had an I, but I really would like to challenge that and make it a C or something like that. Right? And we go back and squirrel it back out. And it seems as though that there are other uses for that. I came across this quote by T.S. Eliot. So where's all the knowledge that we lost in the information? Is there a way in which we could take all of that information and reframe it, package it back up, and put it into the hands of both students and advisors to change the way in which that advising conversation happens, to change the way in which students navigate their way through their degree path? So about a year and a half ago, we began to develop something sort of akin to Netflix, Amazon, Pandora, so many suggestion engines that are out there. We created a new recommendation engine called Degree Compass. And the entire purpose of this was to try to help students to find the right way of choosing the courses in their programs. So let me show you what it looks like so you can get the idea. So this is what it looks like. It's served up on the secure side of our web portal. And so students go to their one-stop account. They pull up this page, and you can see that it provides an interface. It provides a list of courses that they can then consider enrolling in an upcoming semester. And you can see that each of those courses has a little star rating. And in a second, I'll explain what on earth such a star rating might mean. And it's also the case that the interface allows them to see when those courses are available, and we can talk a little bit about that too. The information is also available on our iPhone app. So it's sort of everywhere that they want to be. We want them to have this information. It doesn't require them to input any information. All of the information that's required, all of the data that we need to create the recommendations for this system is all data mined out of our banner system and then presented to them in what we hope is a self-explanatory kind of interface. All right, so how do you do something like that, and what on earth do these stars mean? Well, the first thing to realize is that these stars are not... For Netflix and Pandora and Amazon and so many suggestion engines, the stars are a measure of how much you'll like it. Right? They look to see what kinds of purchases you've made in the past or what kind of music you've listened to in the past, and based on that, then there's some judgment as to what kind of music or movies you might like in the future. That's not going to quite work in a higher education setting, despite the fact that we might really like to take all kinds of classes that we would like to take. What we know is that there are degree requirements which mean that there are going to be some things that maybe we don't like so much, but they're required anyway. So that's not the right model. Instead, the ingredients are created sort of in a several-fold way. First of all, the system goes out and does a reverse degree audit. So it looks to see on the student's transcript not the courses that they have taken, but the courses which, if they were to yet take them, they would satisfy some unmet degree requirement. So now there's a potentially very long list of classes which would be classes that, if they were to take them, they really would count towards their degree. And this is already a huge step forward. If you follow these kinds of discussions, you'll see that there's a lot of national studies recently that show that students, when they graduate from a degree program with about 120 hours, typically speaking, they have about 140 or 150 hours of credit. And it is not the case that they have this 140 hours or 150 hours of credit because of some sort of academic curiosity, that they just kind of like to go out and sort of spread their wings. That's not the case at all. Instead, it is the case that very often students end up taking classes which at the time they think really will apply to their program, only afterwards to discover that it really doesn't. And there you go. Now they've taken things that, okay, it's true that there is learning that has taken place, but if our objective is student success, if our objective is for students to get a useful diploma at the end of that, what we know is that time and money very much are enemies to this. And so finding ways where we can help students to streamline that, it really makes a huge difference. So it's already the case now that everything on the list is something that works. First thing that we do is we rank those courses according to what I call a global centrality. So we create a measure which measures how central each of those courses is to the university's curriculum as a whole. So that way, then, students are taking classes which are the most foundational first, but more than that, they're also taking classes first which are classes which are general purpose. They're classes which, even if they were to change their major, would more than likely still count if they move into that new major. And it really is true in Tennessee, and I don't know about where you're from, but it really is true in Tennessee that students change their major. And when they change their major, very often that creates ramifications. I see that some of them do too for you. All right, so that's that global centrality. Then there is major centrality. So in your particular discipline, if you've chosen one, well, then there are courses which, again, are foundational to that particular major. And so, again, there is another ranking to try to see, to pull out, tease out that facet to say, okay, look, what are the courses which are the most foundational in that discipline? And then that way we can, again, encourage students to take those courses before they take classes that are more specialized. In fact, there's a structure to that that's more nuanced than my guess is that what's going through your head is, yeah, you know, sort of prerequisites and things like that. There's a more nuanced approach to that, and we've used some data mining techniques to pull out a structure of key classes, and there are others who have done similar things to this and have shown great success to this. Key classes, which are, if you like, the sort of the building blocks of the early part of a degree program. You can see here I put up the key classes for the first four semesters of our physics program. And you can see that those classes are sort of non-negotiables. Gradually, a student has to work their way through that part of the curriculum. And it's important for both them and for us to know that they're doing that. And then there are some places in the schedule that are sort of left open for them to put in various different core requirements or various other different kinds of academic requirements. That way, not only can we see them flowing through their program, but it's also the case that they're building towards a further goal. What's surprising is that those key classes are an amazing indicator of success. So by looking at our recent graduates, so this is over the last 5 years of graduates, there are lots of students at Austin Peay who have Fs on their transcript, just as there are at your institutions. What's surprising is that fewer than 2% of the students have more than two Fs in those key classes. So they may make Fs in all kinds of things, but if they make Fs in those key classes, and I know that there are others. The work at Arizona State is a good example of that, where they've seen similar kinds of things, that these classes are an incredibly powerful indicator early on as to how students will unfold as they carry on through their program. All right, so far we've created a ranking which, if you like, is just sort of an individualized degree plan, right? Because we now know classes which would count towards their degree, and we know classes which are the sort of an unfolding scale of this, that someone's going to do Calculus 1 before they do Calculus 2, that kind of thing. So the last piece of this is that we predict the grade that the student would get if they were to take each of those classes which are yet untaken. So, and that's the place where we go back to use the historic grade data. And it turns out that the historic grade data mobilized together with their high school standardized test scores, their high school grades, all of that is enough for us to get a resolution of somewhere about half a letter grade as an estimate for the grade that they will get in the class if they were to take it. So it's very surprisingly accurate, much more accurate than I think. I know that when I put this algorithm together, I didn't really know how accurate, what kind of resolution we might get. I don't know that I was expecting this, but that's what we get. And it turns out that resolution sort of sweeps across the time scale. So as you might suspect, early on when students are taking their initial classes, well, we don't have that much data on them. They haven't taken very many classes. But on the other hand, at that point, we have lots more data from the past about students who have also taken those classes. I'm sure you know that enrollment across institutions is not evenly distributed. So there are a small cohort of gateway classes, which almost everybody takes, that comprise the vast proportion of the university's enrollment. Those are the classes that incoming freshmen are taking. Those are the classes that we have so much data on. And so even with relatively little incoming data from that student, we can make good, precise estimates as to how they might fare if they were to take those classes. Later on, the classes are much smaller. The data that's out there from the past is more sparse, but on the other hand, we know much more about the student. And so there's a trade-off between those two things, and so that gives us that resolution. Perhaps more surprising is the fact that The system is accurate enough to predict whether or not a student gets a C or better about 90% of the time, which, given the fact that life happens, is probably about all that we're ever going to get. Now, there's nothing that we can do about a student getting sick or their finances changing or one of their children having difficulties. It's all kinds of life crops up, certainly on our institution. About 40% of our students are non-traditional students over the age of 25 when they come to us. So they have plenty of life going on outside the classroom. So in that sense, 90% is about all that we're going to get. All right, so now this five-star ranking is, that five-star ranking now measures, in a holistic sense, how much we want to recommend that student to take that class. Because a five-star class for them now is a class which is as central as possible to the institution's curriculum as a whole. It's foundational to their actual major. It's a class which would count if they were to actually take it. And what's more, it's a class which, if they were to take it, they're going to get as good a grade in that class as they might get in any other class that they take. So it's a class which is specifically individualized for them, a sort of personalized approach. Now, at this point, I should pause to say that at our institution, we have taken advising seriously for a very long time. So at our institution, all of our students meet with an advisor, a professional advisor, an academic advisor, every semester. So it is not the case that this system was intended to replace that. Instead, this system was intended to enhance that. Because the reality of life, if any of you have been an academic advisor, is that students walk into that room and, typically speaking, they have no idea what it is they're going to take. They walk in, and now the advisor is in a role of saying, okay, I think you should be taking this. I think you should be taking that. In that sense, the advising session it's very personal, but it's also incredibly localized. What I recently realized as we were meeting with some faculty was that none of us had ever been in a room to see somebody else advise. None of us had ever been in a room to see somebody else advise. And so there was this kind of unwritten understanding of the fact that we understood sort of what happened when we were in there. We've all seen other people teach. We just hadn't seen other people advise. And more than that, then the advice that's being given is thousands and thousands and thousands of completely disconnected one-on-one conversations. And so, you know, if you've been listening to the talks today, isn't that just crying out for those conversations to be sort of linked together, and that there must be a way in which that can be leveraged to produce something which is fundamentally more effective than all of those disconnected conversations? And that's sort of what we're having here. That now, faculty members, when they sit down with a student, in their own discipline, almost everybody is extremely well informed. I'm a mathematician. When I sit down with a student, I really feel like I'm in a position to be able to make good, intelligent suggestions as to what classes they might take in my discipline. But it doesn't have to go very far until that feeling really begins to wane. And if you say to me, well, okay, would I do better to take a class in sociology or psychology? Now, I know the difference between those two disciplines, and I know what it is that's in there, but this student who's sitting in front of me, I have no idea whether they'll fare better in one or other. And there are probably very few people who would. So having a perspective from outside, for me to be able to see, oh, look at that, it's actually the case that it seems that actually you would do better if you were to take this class rather than that. Now, suddenly, that's massively empowering for me. And what's more, it's also massively empowering for the student, because now that dizzying array of choices that they had back right at the very beginning, now it's informed choice. Now, before they walk into that room, they can already have begun to make those kinds of decisions. They understand what that landscape is. And when they walk into the classroom with the faculty member, that conversation can be so much more nuanced than it ever was before. Doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to take the five-star class every time, but they may understand what the choice is. That although in a particular class they might find it much more challenging, they also have a burning interest that's in that direction. All right, so So how does this all play out then for them to be able to make this choice? So this is sort of what the interface looks like, and you can see the little keys next to some of the classes. Those are those key classes. And you can see that on the right-hand side, there's that View Sections button. If they click on that View Sections button, then up pops an interface to show them when that class is going to be available in an upcoming semester. As I mentioned, many of my students have lots of responsibilities outside the classroom, and so it may be that an online class is a better fit. It may be that an evening class is a better fit. It may be that they should be taking that class as one of the branch campuses. It may be that it's more convenient that during the day when their students are, when their children are at school. All of those things are possible, but now they're in a position to be able to make those decisions up front whilst they really are in a place to be able to use the information. And what's more, As you saw, the interface is sort of paced out piece by piece. So there are lots of different degree requirements that are part of an overall degree program, and always will be. Even if we move to a format which is more on a competency base than a credit base, it will always be the case that a program will have some sort of multifaceted approach like this. Now the students can see at a glance, oh, look at that. I haven't satisfied my this, that, or the other requirement. These are the classes which I should be considering. Now I can make a good informed choice about that, what that might be. And as you can well imagine, when you compare an interface like that to the traditional bulletin that we all used, you can imagine that, I don't know, what I can tell you through web traffic is that about a month before priority registration, suddenly there's this massive pickup, and students are trawling all over this website, planning what it is that they're going to do when they meet with their advisors. I just don't believe that a month before students were sitting down sort of pouring through the bulletin. Just didn't happen. Certainly if it did, it didn't work very well, because over the apocryphal stories are that students were not well informed by this. Just in case you are you're worrying about the whether or not a system like this would sort of narrow choice rather than broaden it, I want to ask you a question. If you've used Amazon, Netflix, Pandora, any of these search engines, have you found that they suggest a book or a movie or a piece of music that you've never heard before? Yeah, that's what happens, isn't it? And you hit upon this thing and you go, wow, I'm so glad that that happened, because I never would have heard of that book or movie unless this was suggested to me, and now I find it and I really enjoyed it. It's exactly what happens here. I'll tell you a story about what happened at one of the institutions that we're now working with to put this together. Well, we were talking to one of the advisors, and there was a student, a sort of a test student, and they had not satisfied their foreign language requirement. And what was recommended was Arabic. And the advisor said, well, why not Spanish? And I said, well, why would you expect Spanish? And so she said, well, most people take Spanish. And I said, okay, but, I mean, you know, Arabic looks, apparently it's a decent fit for this student. She said, yeah, but I always recommend Spanish. And it seemed as though that conversation it sort of crystallizes the fact that whilst we might beware a system like this narrowing choice, it's actually as humans that we have a much more limited perspective. That it tends to be the case that the advice we give to somebody tomorrow is much more influenced by the advice we gave to them today. Because that's advice that we solved a problem before, and now we solve it again in much the same kind of way. All right, so does it work? Because if it doesn't produce student success, then I've just wasted the last 30 minutes of your life. And I'm happy to say that it does. I'm happy to say that it does. When students take classes that are recommended to them, they do significantly better in them. And that's the sort of the bottom line of all this. They're much more likely to get an A or a B in the classes that are recommended to them than they are in classes that they choose that are not recommended to them. Now, clearly, we don't have a list that says, whatever you do, don't take this. That's not the way in which this is phrased. The interface itself is an exercise in choice architecture, which is an evolving discipline in itself. But the interface itself is to try to nudge people towards making better decisions than they would otherwise be able to make for themselves. So when they take courses that are recommended to them, they do better. And then the bottom line of it, I think, is those last two points, that when we compared the grades across the institution in the spring, so over 50,000 grades, that there was more than almost a 3-standard deviation shift, an almost 3-standard deviation shift in the proportion of ABC grades we gave across the entire institution. So at our institution, that's roughly 1,500 more A, Bs, and Cs that we gave out in the spring than we did in the previous spring. And if you think about the kind of ramification to that on an individual basis for a student, in Tennessee, for instance, we have a state scholarship, which students get if their ACT score or their high school GPA is good enough when they come out of high school. Every year we have students who, they lose that scholarship. They lose $4,000 a year because their GPA drops below the floor of that. If it drops below 2.75, it's gone. And what we know is that students can weather much, but a change in their financial landscape is very difficult to weather. And what we see is those students, even though, you know, 2.7 at the end of your freshman year is not too bad, it's not great, but it's not bad, they don't come back. They don't come back. So if you don't think that that grade makes a difference, yeah, it makes a difference. It makes a tremendous difference. So we're already starting to see the benefits of that at Austin Peay. I'm very happy to say that the funding formula numbers, which were most recently put out, we were the top of the state in that sense, and so we were very pleased with that. And due to some fabulous support from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and Complete College America, we have been able to take the system that we have at Austin Peay and take it to some other institutions too, to the University of Memphis, which is a large Research One urban institution, and then Nashville State and Volunteer State that are both an urban and a rural community college setting. And at each of those places, we're seeing much the same kind of behavior, that students are taking classes in which they're going to be more successful. All right, so it seems now the case that there is another onus on us, that if it's crucial what students take, well, then students should be taking the classes they need rather than the classes that are left over. And that's a challenge in itself. What I know is that right now my departments are starting to gear up to make the schedule for next fall, and they will complete that early in January for when classes begin in August 2013. What I now see, and what is very clear, is that the way in which that schedule is constructed has massive ramifications on the success of our students. For a long time, the way in which we constructed next year's schedule is we rolled over the last one, right? Now it's the case that we have and are developing predictive models to make sure that we can refine that schedule so that incoming students, they take those gateway classes that they need, not just what's left over at the end. And more than that, when students are taking those key classes, that we can see them flowing through. And so we can make sure that if it's your time to take that class, well, then that class is there for you to take. And I know that there are others who have done similar things and seen that that's a powerful thing. So the kind of interface that we create is something akin to this, which shows all the way through the summer a combination of what seats have been used, what seats are available, what seats are online, what seats haven't been opened yet, but perhaps most important of all, where it is that we think that we will be. Because you know what? If you look down there at ART 1030, I don't know if you can, I think it's big enough where you can see it. ART 1030 doesn't have enough seats. And we can already see this. And so as a provost, rather than picking up the phone on the 10th of August and saying to the department chair of ART, you know what, I need 10 more sections of that. Can you get busy? We can have that conversation back in February. And that's all the difference in the world. All the difference in the world. All right, so that's the landscape for courses. What about majors? What about majors? What we know is that when students come to the institution, about 20% of our students are undecided when they first arrive on our campus. They don't know what major they want to take. And about half of the students who know what they want to take, by the end of the first year, they've changed to something else. So the choice of major is extraordinarily important on my campus and on yours too. What I also know is that the way in which students go about choosing their major is about as ill-informed as the way in which they go about choosing those courses. Because often they don't really know what is entailed in a particular major. If you don't believe this, if you just look at the list of incoming majors, there are a lot of majors that are just missing. And they're missing because students have no idea what they are. They don't know what people who have that kind of qualification go off and do. And worse than that, very often when you talk to people about, well, what do you do with a particular qualification? If you get a degree in math, what can you do with that? I don't know how many times I've had the conversation with people who say, well, you know what, I thought of studying math, but I don't want to be a math teacher. Now, we need math teachers, I'm not saying we don't. But to check math off your list because you don't want to be a math teacher, and because you don't know the kind of spectrum of different opportunities that are out there with a math degree, that's not right. It's, again, a gaping hole of information which we need to fill. And that, for mathematics, is true for every discipline. You know it as well as I. So the challenge there is to try to capture, so what's distinctive about what's each particular discipline? And then again, this is a piece of data mining for us to go out and to see, so what are the courses which are, if you like, the fingerprint courses, the courses which really carry the flavor of each particular discipline? That way we'll be able to separate one discipline from another. It isn't the things that they have in common which is helpful, it's the things that they don't have in common which is helpful. And so, again, we have developed a list of courses that are part of our curriculum, which are the fingerprint courses for each discipline, for each program, for each major. And since Degree Compass is able to predict grades effectively, of course, the central limit theorem is also in my favor. So as soon as if I can predict grades well, I can predict averages much more effectively. And so I can calculate a fingerprint GPA for each major. And so consequently, we find ourselves in a position to be able to recommend programs to students as well as courses. So today I'm happy to introduce My Future, which is a new interface for our students that we launched about a week ago. And so for those students, where they are able to both see for the major that they're in, can show you something about what the interface looks like. You can see that for the major that they're in, it shows them information which they need to know. It shows them what kinds of concentrations are open to them in that discipline, what kinds of careers are open to them if they follow that discipline. Perhaps equally important, if they see that the major that they're in is one which they is not suited to them, or if they're undecided, then the system is able to provide some options. And again, rather than all of the options that we have on campus, this interface presents the top six. Again, using this approach of nudging people towards successful decisions. So the top six programs, which if they were to take them, they will be the most academically successful. I have no idea about their interests. I have no idea about those non-cognitive things, and it's clear that that's an area which it would be wonderful to explore. But what I do know is that if I'm able to present these options, then students can explore them to see whether or not they're a good fit for them. So if this student suddenly looks at agriculture and says, you know, I never even thought about that, that's an interesting option, then they can look further into the interface to see, okay, so what do people do with a degree in agriculture? What kinds of careers are on the other side of that? And more than that, what does that look like? What kind of courses do you take if you're going to take a degree in agriculture? And so you can see there that we give a list of courses, the courses which are the courses which we think that this student will be successful in, and that's the reason why we're recommending agriculture to them. And the jobs linked to the Department of Labor's website. So they're then able to explore what kind of jobs are out there, what the employment market might look like. So I think this is a really exciting kind of landscape. Clearly, these are two interfaces that we've launched at our institution, but they are helping our students in a very important way, I think. And as this field unfolds, then I'm sure that we'll be able to refine it still more. I'd like to stop there. Thank you. So I think there's a little time for some questions, if there are any. Yes, sir.
Some clarification on the My Future and how that works. So I'm a high school student, and I'm coming into the university, and I haven't taken any courses yet at the university, and I'm trying to figure what major I should choose. So is there some way that application can help me?
Yes, that's a great question. So the question was, if this is an incoming high school student and we don't really have much transcript data, will it help? So as things stand, we are wanting to be prudent and wait a little until we have some information. But what we are doing is trying to frame the choice. So when a student first comes to us, often it is the case that it isn't that they don't know anything that they want to do. Instead, they sort of know broadly what they want to do. And so we've created what we call macro majors. So health sciences, STEM fields, arts, humanities, social sciences, business, education. These are broad areas. And so what we do is to encourage students to find, you know, it's kind of like at least we can choose if you're going on holiday, do you want the beach or the mountains? And so if we can get them into that, then gradually over time they can refine that. And as we know more transcript information, so we can help that refinement. It's a great question. Yeah.
Hi. This is just incredibly cool and wonderful. I was wondering if you have any ideas about repurposing either the design or the software itself as a kind of community that people can share.
Sorry, could you just say one more time?
Do you have any ideas perhaps around repurposing either the design or the software of this in such a way that other institutions can use it?
Yes. Yes, so we've actually done the work to be able to work with other institutions, at least provided right now they are running Banner. And then we are hoping to be able to speak to other campus management systems as time goes on. But yeah, we are beginning to license this software to other institutions. Yes. Thank you. Yes, sir.
Yes, I don't know if you could share some experience on how it affected your either four-year graduation rate or years to graduate. It may be too premature. And second part of that is any ability to know how it affects financial aid and students exhausting their financial aid or possibly accruing greater debt or less debt because they're taking more focused courses.
Yeah, those are things that we absolutely hope will be impacts. We've only been using this software at Austin Peay since spring 2011,
So
it's far too premature to say that we've have an impact on graduation yet, but it absolutely is the case. You saw the shift in ABC rates, and that all goes to helping students move through programs more effectively. And we absolutely think that... I mean, it's a real and present difficulty for so many of our students that they get very close to graduating and then they exhaust their aid. And so this kind of thing precisely gives them the information that they need to be able to not do that. Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes.
Hi. Can you comment on the degree to which your courses at your school are standardized down to the section level formally and how much or little the effectiveness of the software depends on students being able to guarantee that they're going to have a similar experience in one section of the course that they would have in a different section?
Yeah, that's a great question. So at our institution, gateway classes are gradually becoming more standardized. So other work that we've been doing has been in the work of course redesign, of looking at large multi-section classes and finding ways to teach those where faculty work as a team rather than as a group of individuals. In those classes, it's clear that the experience is much more uniform than in classes which are further on down the food chain, if you like, where there's only single sections. But it seems as though the resolution on the grade predictions that we're getting, they seem to be fairly forgiving in that sense. And as some people have said, well, look, have you corrected for the faculty member? And we have not. We don't go to that level. But it is the case that there is a large amount of variation here which is not dependent on what happens in the classroom. But there are lots of things that happen outside the classroom that have a massive effect. So I think all of this will gradually become refined over time, but that's where we are right now. Yeah. Yes, sir.
Hi, this is very impressive, by the way.
Thank you.
The STAR system is by global centrality, major centrality, and grade prediction.
Yes.
Now, that means you could have students in your classroom who are predicted to, you know, maybe it's a 3-star as far as grades are concerned, but it's critical to their major.
Mm-hmm.
Do you find that, or do you expect to tailor your teaching to those students or build a support system to, you know, help them from the start?
Yeah, so that's something I didn't touch on today, but it's absolutely, there is an enterprise side of this, which I didn't touch on today.
Okay.
Of course, it's the case that we can now predict the grades that students will get from the moment that they enroll in them. And as an institution, we are using that as part of an early alert system,
mm-hmm.
to sort of gather around students who we know will have a very challenging semester, team them up with academic support, with mentoring, and try to help them to weather what could be a very challenging semester in something which is critical but difficult. Yeah,
thank
absolutely.
You.
One more, thank you.
Yeah, I guess I have a question about whether or not you've had any pushback from faculty, maybe regarding bell curves, because it sounds like this is actually has the potential to increase grades, and they have the potential to actually change the bell curve. Have you had that?
Yeah, so pushback from faculty? That never happens, does it? No. Actually, I will say that our faculty has been extremely supportive of this. They really have. And it has been because we have taken steps forward as a partnership. There has been very much a change in thinking on our campus that the way in which grades should be assigned is because of quality of work, not because of some sort of a quota. And so having high expectations of academic integrity and then finding ways for an increasing proportion of students to meet those, that's the way in which we're trying to attack this on our campus. So in that sense, there is a danger, I think, in anything in this sense of some sort of quality erosion. But we built an infrastructure to try to make sure that that doesn't happen. And that's been part of that picture, for faculty to be assured that this is not a challenge on academic integrity. I'm the chief academic officer. Over and over again, the only thing that is not up for grabs at our institution is our academic standing. So it's very important. Thank you very much.